Welcome to the Make Big Happen podcast. I'm Mark Moses, founder and chairman of CEO Coaching International, and my guest today is Fred Crescetto, founder and chairman of Amex Group and the founder of iSupport, a business he originally built to support his own operating companies before scaling it to serve others. Fred and I met a long time ago through YEO, Young Entrepreneurs Organization. It was about 30 years ago, and we've grown our friendship through EO and YPO over the years. Since 2017, Fred and his leadership teams have been coached by our firm across all three of his companies. I've seen him when the ground gave out beneath him. In December 2019, my wife Yvette and I visited Fred and his wife Norma in China. Fred had been living there with his family for 11 years. I toured his office, even did an impromptu session with his leadership team. Everything felt stable and settled. Weeks later, the pandemic hit. Fred and his family were forced to leave immediately, and he's never been back since. At the same time, Amex's business exploded as his demand for medical-grade gloves went through the roof. The company had to step up fast, scale fast, and operate in total chaos. And then the world shifted again. Suddenly, as COVID ended, the demand collapsed and the business whiplashed. Most leaders break into moments like that. Most leaders break in moments like that, but Fred did not. And here's what makes this story even more interesting. In the midst of building businesses in navigating global crises, Fred also chose to live big. He's climbed 6 of the 7 highest peaks in the world, everything but Everest. And at 60 years old, when most people are slowing down, Fred decided to become world-class at something new. He joined the national team for a company he'll tell us about shortly and competed in the World Championship for cross-country skiing. This episode's about leadership, resilience, reinvention, and deciding who you are before circumstances decide for you. Fred Crescetto lives and is clearly a guy who makes big happen. Fred, welcome to the Make Big Happen podcast.
Great to be here, Mark.
Well, so you moved to Asia in your early 20s without a safety net, entered an industry you knew nothing about. What made you take that leap, and what made you stay when maybe others would have quit?
You know, it's a great question. I grew up in Seattle, West Coast. Ever since when I was a kid, I was always doing something. I had some kind of side business, you know, whether it was selling vegetables or mowing lawns or whatever. Early on, I just felt that running your own business was just way more fun than working for somebody else. I went to college, graduated from the U. I really wanted to go to the import-export business, kind of, I should say, international business. And that wasn't like in the mid-80s a big deal. But for me, I wanted to, I guess, you know, you look at it and I wasn't, I guess, visioning it like I maybe like looking back now over the what I've done in the last 40 years. But I really wanted to have a business where I could just had adventure, that it was a journey, that we could go around the globe and do something. Growing up in the 80s, I remember I read this book my senior year by, it was about megatrends, and the 9th megatrend was Asia. Now, and I said, well, I'm going to go to Asia. Closest I'd ever been to Asia was the Four Seas restaurant in King Street, downtown Seattle. And I just packed my bags and went to Asia for 7 months and traveled around and went to every country. Came back and I said, hey, I think the best opportunities are in Taiwan. And so I packed my bags again. And when I was 23 years old, moved to Taiwan and said, I'm going to do something. And then about a year later, a guy calls me up and he says, you know anything about latex gloves? And I said, what do you want to know? Didn't know anything. And looked in the opportunity. The world was changing. AIDS was taking off. And so we said, look, I'll do this with you, but I want to be involved. And a couple of us started the company. And that's kind of how Amex was started.
You make me laugh with the vegetables. It's funny. We grew up in different places. I grew up in Canada, and we were selling oranges and grapefruits, and here you're selling vegetables in Seattle.
Well, my grandfather had a farm, and I would go work, help him on the weekends, and The thing was, if I helped him, I could carry, you know, I could have all the vegetables I could carry away. And then I just went door to door. Probably get arrested for that now. Back when you're 10 or 12 years old and, you know, I was learning to sell. So,
yeah, good for you. Great skill to learn at such a, hey, learn when we were in high school. So how did living and operating in Asia for as long as you did shape how you see business differently?
Well, you know, early on, I started in Asia right away. I was working with somebody else. We started Amex. I had a number of different partners. Yet I have to say that, you know, and a lot of you always have this vision of your business is supposed to go like this. Ours pretty much went like this. I wasn't really going anywhere. I fundamentally thought it was going to be a good business, but all the guys I was working with more or less just basically decided to, you know, do something else and quit. And I just kind of acquired all their shares. On top of that, we had borrowed some money from one of the banks to start the business, and we hadn't done a really good job of executing. And so we found ourselves kind of upside down with them. And I had a personal guarantee on that. And that's when I learned the hard way about, you know, personal guarantees. And I went to the guys and said, look, I'll get you out of all this. You got to give me your shares, and just kind of stuck with it. By that point, I was back in the U.S. kind of working, but I'd going back and forth a lot, developing relationships with the manufacturers. Now, understand, this is really early on. So this is this is a hand-to-mouth business. And it wasn't a business where people were lined up to invest in or do anything. I mean, you know, this is, you don't even think about disposable gloves back then. There was only two ways that you could sell gloves. Either you sold them to doctors or you sold them to dentists. And the medical, the business was controlled by a big oligopoly. So I just get on the phone and just dial for dollars, calling every dentist I could. And that's how we started the business. I went back into Asia and I said, hey, I want to develop these brands. You back me now. I won't forget who you are. And we'll work together. And that's kind of how we got the business going, because I did not have any money. I talked to manufacturers. I remember going to 15 different manufacturers over a summer, and one after another, trying to talk one of them into giving me a container of gloves to sell. Ultimately, a guy just goes, okay, we'll do it. And that's kind of brought that over, paid him off, you know, and over time as we sold it and just built it from there.
Why? I don't think I've ever asked you this, but why latex gloves?
Well, you know, I didn't have, you got to remember, I never worked for anybody. So I never had a job coming out of school. I was always doing my own. My last job, I was a tour guide on the Love Boats. And so when I went to do something, and I was talking about importing, doing international business, I did not come from a background like in the medical industry or auto parts or anything like that. I just looked at that and I said, well, you know what? This is going to be a lot of demand for these things. Plus, you use them and you throw them away. Once again, there was no business plan. It was more like, God, if we can sell enough of these, maybe we can go out to dinner on Saturday night. So it was, that was it. But it was like, hey, if the world's changing and there's a trend, and this trend at that particular time, which we didn't call it, was kind of health, hygiene, and safety. You know, who knew that the world would go from selling, you know, using a couple billion gloves to, you know, I don't know, maybe trillions of gloves.
I remember coming to visit you in, it was December 2019, and I remember you taking me for a tour around the city, took me to the coolest Starbucks I've ever seen, the superstore, whatever that thing was called. It was amazing, and it just appeared to be booming, and you guys had an amazing life there. And then you had the pandemic happens, and you had to leave suddenly. What was going through your mind when... And really, you've never been back yet again?
Well, I've never been back to China. Let me clarify on the facts there. When you came, that was early December. And we actually, if you recall, we did that. We organized that event, that dinner for EO, and you spoke. Next day, I left and came to Seattle. Family came a little bit later. And then Chinese New Year was early that year. It was about the third week of January. So I stayed in Seattle. They went back to school. And in China, and then we were going to meet. They said, yeah, we really want to go skiing in Europe. So we had planned to go to Europe. So I went to Europe. I'm in Europe, and they come from Europe, from China to Europe to go to school. I mean, to ski for a while. And then they were there about ready at the end of January to go back to China. And they said, whoa, 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 you know, school's closed for a week. So you got to do remote. So we stayed there. Now, and this was an interesting time because if you recall, you know, the pandemic first started to hit in China. But when it first started to hit, you know, this was no, and we remember we did a podcast on this around mid-February. I didn't think this was going to be anything more than like bird flu, swine flu, H1N1. I mean, you know, we saw something like this happen every 2 to 3 years. I just thought this was just going to be, you know, something different. But later on, there was actually things because of we were doing business in China that actually helped us because we were kind of on the cutting edge of seeing things happen. And we said, well, if that comes to North America, all these things are going to happen. So we write kind of like we had the first version of the movie before anybody else was seeing it, you know, in the U.S. because we had built a business domestically in China, as you recall, that really replicated what we were doing in the United States. When we started in China in 2010, I didn't originally go to live there to do that. We were doing trading. And I got to, you know, it's one of those classic business things. I'm there in 2007. We moved the family over there. We're doing that. We're looking at the business. And I'm going, we're in the wrong business. We're never going to be able to scale this thing. And somebody says, no, but we're doing like $6 or $7 million. We're making money. I said, yeah, but it's going nowhere. And let me tell you why it's going to go even less nowhere. You know, then the global financial crisis came along and just pretty much wiped a lot of that business out. But we'd already agreed, and that kind of just proved the model. Like, I didn't think that would do. So I'm kind of in China looking like, well, what are we going to do? And I go, we can sell gloves in China. And at this particular time, you want to talk about vision. The average American was using like 140 gloves a year. The average Chinese person was using one. So just imagine if we can go from one to three, and if we could get a piece of that, what that's like. Anyways, so we look around and I said, well, we got to start selling gloves. Well, people were selling gloves, but nobody was selling, you know, everything was, there was like white box stuff. So we were the first company to come into China and brand gloves. We came in, we branded gloves. And then what we did, we were the first ones to sell branded gloves online. And because we perceived ourselves as a famous foreign brand, we were one of two companies to get on Tmall or Alibaba and have the gloves on Alibaba. And so once we had that, that gave us like instant credibility that we were, we were there. Now, how does that relate back to what we were doing in 2019? So we were outside China. That's, the pandemic hits. We're waiting. Looks like we're not going to get back because it was all going, but nothing was going on in the U.S. So we went back to Seattle and we're waiting. It's okay. As soon as this is over, we'll catch a flight, go back to China. Then all hell broke loose at the end of February in the U.S. and just never could go back. And it was really unfortunate for the kids because they had lived their entire lives in China. Their whole community was there. They'd gone to school there and they just kind of had to finish up in the U.S. And a lot of, and my story was not uncommon with a lot of people. They just kind of found yourself going back in. But I wasn't just going to go back and be quarantined every 3 weeks, you know, when you're there and tested and things like that. But that was a challenge. And that was just different that you have a whole life there for a long time. And then one day you just never go back. We had our own house. We had our own stuff. We actually owned a house in China, which was unusual. And so it was really, really strange how that ended. We still had the business in China. We still have all the people. We have everything we do, everything like that. But just on a personal level, this didn't go back.
All personal belongings, the kids' stuff, everything left in the house.
Yeah, imagine you just like you walk out the door one day and you close your door and then you never go back. And your entire house that you lived in for 10 years is there with everything, you know, from your toothbrush to your dog to, you know, everything, your entire life. They grew up, their entire lives, they grew up in this one house for 11 years. And then they just walked out the door and you just, you never went back.
Wow, that must have been so tough on your kids.
Well, if you layer that too, then you come to the United States and remember all the stuff with COVID where, you know, couldn't go out, you couldn't meet anybody. Then there we were in a state where they didn't go to school for 2 years. So my poor son does junior and senior year online on Zoom, finally gets to go his senior year to like the third week of April, gets to go in person to class. So it wasn't the same high school experience that you and I had. So a little different.
Yeah. So demand takes off for gloves. It goes crazy. How big did the business get, or in what percentage did you grow during that period of time, and how quick, and what was the hardest part of that meaningful, like really meaningful growth during COVID?
You know, it's interesting you asked the question. I look at it in two senses. We were building our business in North America, which we had been around on, and we thought 2020 was going to be a great year. We were super excited with what we were doing in China. Right at the beginning of, in China, the domestic market in China, about 2 to 3 weeks before Chinese New Year, everything just shuts. You can't get anything picked up. You can't do anything. We just more or less just sit around your thumbs. There's this great migration of 400 or 500 million people just happens moving around. So I remember calling when my son who was working for me, and this is right at the end of December, and I go, hey, how did the meetings in Wuhan go? And he goes, oh, we didn't go. And I was like, I was not happy. What do you mean you didn't go? I wanted you down there. We had to have those meetings. He goes, nah, there's like, everybody was canceling everything. They're getting some kind of flu or something like that. I wasn't exactly empathetic towards the thing. So I said, okay. Well, then about a week later, basically the business should just have wound down and been doing nothing. I'm looking at the reports every day and we're selling like insane amount of stuff in China. And I call them up and go, is this right? And they go, yeah, that's right. And I go, well, how are we delivering it? And we go, we're not. And I go, well, what do you mean we're not? And they go, they're coming to pick it all up. And it's mean that was like, people were coming through all our warehouses to pick everything up, which was unusual. So we looked at it in the US side and we said, hey, you know what? This thing could get big. Let's call our manufacturers. We called our manufacturers and doubled our orders for the US. And nobody's doing anything right now. Because we were in China, we saw this and we went down and we said, okay, let's double our orders. Now we sell a product, so we can only sell as much as we have. What we learned from the last situations of H1N1, you know, bird flu, swine flu, that anytime you had something like this, you had this kind of opportunity for like 90 days or 120 days. It reset the bar higher, but it didn't like double everything or triple it. So we ordered a bunch more. Meantime, everything in China continues to go crazy. So then I remember being in Europe and I called the guys again and go, look, let's order even more. And this is a classic of being kind of like owning your own business and being owned by private equity. If the CFO had been on that call and I had said, let's double down again, he would have called the partners over at the PE company and said, I think the guy is in Geneva on something. Don't put the POs through. But we put the orders through. We got it going. It was Chinese New Year. Southeast Asians aren't doing anything. We bring a lot of gloves, not only from China, but for North America, most of our stuff comes from Southeast Asia. Orders start pouring in. So we start selling more. Chinese New Year comes back. It's kind of crazy. When we're seeing more and more demand, we are more, US is starting to pick up too. So we went and then we said, well, let's make more orders. And the manufacturer said, well, we got an increase of 5% or something, which in our business is a big deal. So we said, okay, how about 2? And they said, okay, we'll take 2. And this was another fundamental thing where we went left and everybody else went right. Our competitors said, we're not paying you anything. You have our POs, we're not paying the increase. And what happened was, a lot of our competitors was 60, 90 days later, those manufacturers never shipped those goods. They said, those POs were unresolved. We never shipped them. And so they were like out. So we now have like gloves are pouring in, it's taking off. And then all of a sudden, like everything just took off. But it's building up steady. You know, it was kind of like the first, like, you know, remember things in COVID, I don't know where you were, but really they didn't start to close things down to mid-March. And there was all kind of crazy uncertain things you forget now, like in our state, was like, you're an essential business. What the heck is an essential business? I think we're essential selling gloves, but I don't know if the governor thinks we're essential. So we're down there, you know, we had some workers who wouldn't come in. I got all my kids down there working in the warehouse. I mean, I must be like Scrooge, you know, and we're having fun. I mean, anyway, we just took off and we started selling and once again, they raised the prices. We bought more and we flooded the orders. And so we really had a ton of stuff coming. So we started, by the time you start the pandemic and you get, I would say, you start at the beginning of the year and you get to the end of the year. We saw in terms of revenue, just in that 1 year, like a 300%, almost, you know, 400% increase. Now, part of that was stimulated by units. A lot of it was stimulated by just increasing prices. You know, the manufacturers were pretty, you know, it was pretty business as usual till about April or May. But then the second half of the year, when anybody who decided they were in PPE, I used to laugh about that. They'd say, I'm in PPE. If you had asked some of you like what PPE was in 2019, they would have said either it was a synthetic drug or a Korean boy band. You know, but by then, everybody knows what PPE is and everybody, you know, coming out of the woodwork. And this created some issues for us because what ended up happening was the manufacturers started coming back and saying, you know, hey, prices, you know, we really appreciate your forethought. And I'm glad that you just, you know, you put in orders for 1 billion gloves, but we're only going to give you 200 million or 250 million gloves or something like that. So on Friday, you think you're great. You come in on Monday, your chessboard's just kind of like whacked on the floor. And so that went there. And then that same thing's happening in China. I mean, we took that business in China from 2010, our first year, we went from 400,000 to 2020, we did 100 million. And so it was just off to the market. Now, remember when we went in to this industry too, was we'd been in the business. We'd been in that business a long time. You know what I mean? So we weren't, you know, babes in the woods. Because of our relationships, because we had the, you know, we had, there's a lot of positive things that we had. We were able to kind of, and we made some bets. Now, we also, it was a challenging time for a lot of our competitors. Two of our biggest competitors got wiped out during the pandemic. One went to Chapter 11 bankruptcy on the back end that you kind of mentioned when things collapsed. Another one was basically a fire, you know, a fire sale in the middle of the night to something. But the entire landscape of our industry got reshifted. And we actually, by the time we came out, we had, you know, higher revenues, way higher profits, way better systems, you know, we just won all along. And there's a couple like things when we were talking a little beforehand about things that were different. We did a couple of things going in that really helped us. And this was a lot was, you know, helped by our coach I was working with. And we looked at the business and it's one of those things where, you know, what Jim Collins talks about confronting the brutal facts. And in 2018, I got a young guy running the company. He's taking over. He's kicking ass. He's got a CEO coach. And we looked around. I said, you know, I go, what do you think? And he goes, we just sat through a manager meeting. And I go, I think we got to fire everybody. And he goes, what? And I go, not you, but I think we got to fire everybody else. And you and I have to replace the entire C-suite. And we just had a dysfunctional team. There were some good people, but they had taken us to a level and they couldn't get any higher. And a couple of that was on the fact is like, I had stepped down. He had stepped in. There was some conflict with some people that said, well, I'm not really reporting to him. And he was, and so we rebuilt them. We built the management team, completely redid the team in 2018. They got everything going in 2019, rebuilt the systems, and we just had to. If we had not done that, we would have been wiped out by the pandemic too. And that was just one of those moments where you know, as you go on your journey as a founder, a CEO, super important to do. And then there was one other tiny little thing we did in retrospect was because we saw everything coming out of China, I came back and I said, well, what the heck happens if nobody can go to work? And so, you know, we can't go to the office. And they said, okay. So in January of 2020, we made people stay home from work one day, the entire company, every day, like 4 or 5 weeks in a row. And we pressure tested people working from home with the technology. And then 6 weeks later, you know, the blows up and nobody's in the office. And then some people never came back, you know, they're just working from home. But if we had not done that, not had the systems, not had the right CTO, not had the right leadership team, we would have fallen behind and never caught back up.
This is brilliant foresight, whether it's foresight or lucky, pressure testing one day a week at home before the whole world shut down. It's incredibly fortuitous that you got to do that and test that. How did you maintain? So when this the world blows up, your demand is escalating. How do you maintain culture? You're no longer in the country anymore at the company that you were probably at almost every day.
Well, I mean, that was a great thing. You know, I will say, you know, you think back on your kind of your career or what you did and, you know, I look at it more as like you look back on your journey. And I think one of the things that I really underestimated was culture. You know, when we first, you and I both started working with Vern Harnish a lot with scaling up early on and things like that, you know, people, culture, strategy, execution. I would just, truth be told, I didn't place as big of an emphasis on as I should have. When it really started, the culture really became pronounced for us was when we went to China. And then we built out in China. So how do we take that culture that we had that was the essence of our DNA from North America, and bring that as a, you know, as a foundational element of what we want to do in China. Same thing in the Philippines. When we came and built our teams out in the Philippines, same things when we went global, culture became a big deal. I think I was fortunate in China that I was, you know, when we built the teams out, because so I can never go back. I'm running these guys. I'm working with them through WeChat, everything like that. I had just worked side by side with these guys for this team, ladies and men, for like 10 years and built belief. I always said that our biggest competitor in China was belief. When I first said, hey, we're going to sell gloves, they're looking at me like, what are you talking about? I said, no, people will use these, believe me, you know, yeah. And they have this like, oh, okay, ha, ha, ha. And he's like, yes. They're going like, whatever. I'm not going over the cliff in the Ferrari with this guy. So, you know, when we had to build the market out and it got bigger and bigger and bigger, but we had built the team. And I think by then they were ready to go. And, you know, that team is still in place and still kicking ass. On the U.S. side, the same thing is, it just, look, business changed. I kind of fundamentally look at business pre-pandemic and post-pandemic. We look at things where, hey, how many people do we know, probably including ourselves, and say, I want everybody in the office every day. These are my peeps. I got a habit, culture, values, vision. It's really important to me. I want to have a war room, whatever. Today, it's like, yeah, you know what? If we want to tap into the best talent in the world, let's do that. And let's get those A players on the team, whether and if that person's in Boston or Bolivia or Batangas, let's get them on the team. War room, fine. It's a virtual war room. We don't have to have it all like, you know, like it was. So I think all that, you know, that the pandemic changed that and they adapted. Today, I can tell you still on all our teams globally, nobody's in the office. And you'd say, well, has culture been impacted? It's something we look at. All the CEOs look at it and follow it. But we also tie, you know, kind of culture to productivity. How's the team doing? Are we growing? Are we developing? Are we doing? It's just different than it was. It's just not going back to where we're not going back to 2019. I think we have to go forward with it and go from there. So that was a big deal. And but I think all the CEOs that were running companies, you know, at this particular point when the pandemic hits, Mark, I'm not running anything anymore. I had made a conscious decision that I was not going to be the CEO. So I was not the CEO of any company when the pandemic hit.
Well, take me through this then. So it's the whiplash, Fred, that was insane. I remember your business takes off. You said up 300%. How much did it fall percentage-wise when demand fell off? And then you had to regroup then with demand falling that quickly.
Well, there's a couple of things we did also. On the way up, it was kind of funny. Like I said, we had seen this before, and we had struggled in previous ones. I could tell you, we did not do well in some of the previous ones. And one of the mistakes was we did not have controls, and when all hell broke loose, because suddenly people call up and say, oh, I want to buy 10,000 cases, and a sales rep goes, yes. But that client may be buying 1,000. So right away, we had systems in place, and there was a couple of things we did early on. We instituted what I call glove communism. Everybody gets something and nobody's happy. So if you were a client, you got 120% of your yearly rolling average. So if you were buying, let's say 1,000 cases, I'm going to sell you 1,200. I'm not selling you 12,000. So what we did is we preserved inventory so everybody got something. Okay. So that was a big one. Second was, we didn't take on any new, like, people calling up in emergencies. Oh, we need this, we need that, whatever. We had learned from the past that was just transactional and they didn't want us and they would go away. But what we did do is we took 25% of our inventory, we set it aside, and we created a whale hunting team. And our top sales reps went out hunting whales. The clients that we always wanted, but we never could get, and we went for them. Today, so we hunted a lot of whales and we came out of the pandemic with a lot of whales. We also then went out and we said, look, we know we're going to be bigger, better, and stronger when this thing's over. So we went out and started poaching as much talent. We targeted people that we wanted in the industry to come work for us. And we went out and found people. I remember doing interviews with people. We flew into Seattle. We're sitting in a giant room, like 6 feet apart in like a giant circle, like we're in kindergarten. You know what I mean? And doing that, we brought in a CRO during the pandemic that was under a 2-year non-compete. And I said, fine, hire him anyways. The first year, all I did was work on the team and systems and everything like that. And we brought him out. So we invested, you know, we did a lot of things heavily in that. Look, when it went up, it came down. The hardest thing about coming down was, well, there's a lot of things. Coming down was a lot harder than going up. And the biggest challenge was, is that we could not get all the products that we wanted during the pandemic, the ones that we needed to sell. We were kind of like forced to say, hey, you like bananas? Great, I got bananas today. What about apples? Hey, I got these really nice bananas, you know? So we didn't have everything that everybody wanted. It started to go down. We started to get it more, but we had to deal with people on rack. You know, we're selling a product that's kind of a commodity. And as the price is collapsing in Asia, it's kind of starting to collapse here. And people are used to paying X and all of a sudden it's X20. I mean, it's like it's heading towards the bottom, but you don't know where the bottom is. And that was the biggest deal. So we go back to manufacturer and say, hey, I want to buy this product from you. Let's say, and the price is $50. And they said, well, the price is 70. Yeah, but that's not where it's going to be in 2 weeks from now. So we really, you know, we had to like sit down belly to belly with a lot of our partners and say, guys, it's a brave new world now. It's not what it was. And this is a hard thing. And we had clients too. I mean, this is a big thing. I was thinking about this today. You know, we had a lot of clients that they had bought product and they were just used to just taking orders. And then all of a sudden they just, those orders evaporated, and maybe something that they paid $100 for now had a market price of 20. And they're coming back after a year, year and a half saying, hey, I want to return this stuff. No. You know, we'll work with you on some stuff or help you. So there was a lot of that. And that's what killed a lot of people. So coming down and navigating that down was hard. I kind of look at where do we end up post. I kind of think as last year, about 24, 25 was kind of last year where you really came down. I mean, there's stuff, Mark, that people were suddenly, you know, it's stuff that people are paying, you know, a 2 cents on the dollar for. In 23 and 24. So it also made the market hard. How do you gain consistency? How do you rebuild your message? How do you get out front on all these things? So that really kind of cleared up in 24, 25 and rebuilt it. You know, we find ourselves now probably almost double what we were pre-pandemic in terms of top line, substantially better, we're much more improved on the bottom line. Our systems are way better. Our people are way better. And we're in a situation where, you know, we're going to continue to grow because although it's a tough, tough market and there's no shortage of headwinds, it's cleaned up a lot too. And so I think the factors that we like lean into, like consistency, service, taking care of people that we used through the pandemic really paid off. And those are continuing to be valued now. And those are just some of the things that we did, but it was not easy. When something's collapsing, it wasn't so much the demand, it was the pricing and how you rode that down. And it was tough.
So if you could summarize in this sentence, biggest lesson learned on the way up, biggest lesson learned on the way down.
You know, I think the biggest thing was, I think it comes down to leadership. And I think what leadership was, and this is not, I'm telling like the team, my leaders did, when this started to take off, we set a vision of where this was going. And we, you know, we made sure we communicated with the team. We listened to the team, but then we all aligned and we executed. And we did that on the way up. And then we did that on the way down. And, you know, in terms of that, when I say down, you come off this like Red Bull high and you're just going down, you got only one way to go. And the question is like, are you going to lose control or are you going to say, don't worry, hang on, we're going to do this, we're going to take it through here? And we did that. You know, one of the things that we did that I think was just incredible in leadership is in tough situations like this was almost right away when the pandemic did hit, we went to two huddles a day. We did a 10 a.m. and a 4:30 p.m. And there was two huddles a day with senior leadership on that huddle. And that went on for almost 4 years. And that's where you're going to get alignment, because literally there was so many tactical changes, you know, that were just there and they had to do that. And then you're talking about working over, you know, an 18-hour time zone We had to make sure we were locked and loaded with our teams on the ground in Southeast Asia, our teams in China, our teams in the Philippines. And so they went out. I mean, that was it. I just think it's like, hey, it's alignment. You communicate, you listen, you align, and you execute.
So I support. I think it's super clever what you did there. Tell us why you set up iSupport and how you've leveraged that. You set up to help yourself. Tell us about why you did that, and then tell us where it is today.
So, you know, iSupport's a separate company. What happened there was, you know, we're up in Seattle, early 2000s. I'm selling disposable gloves out of a warehouse in 25 miles south of Seattle. And you got Microsoft and Amazon and Starbucks and Costco and all these really cool companies. And who wants to sell gloves? Not in the most days, nobody wants to sell gloves. Nobody wants to, you know, if you can go anything, I want to be a janitor at Microsoft and be a millionaire, or I want to sell gloves. That's not hard. So we were really struggling getting people to do, you know, kind of just really important blocking and tackling, client services, sales support. And plus, we're in Seattle, which is a much higher wage structure than other parts of the country. Because of our stuff in Asia, we were in there right about this time. I don't recall, Tom Friedman wrote a book called The World is Flat. I'm in the Philippines for this YPO, YPO regional university in Manila. I go and I listen to a couple of these guys talk about, they're going to do this thing on The World is Flat. And the three people talk for an hour and a half about how they built businesses in the Philippines and what they did to help, you know. And I went up to afterwards, and I'm not shy. I went up and said, hey, talk to them. What, you know, what's going on? How'd you do this? And I said, well, come on by my place. So we went by, looked at their, went, came back a couple weeks later, you know, went to their place at 11 o'clock at night till 6 o'clock in the morning. I remember talking to one guy, and I go, we can do this. So the next month, I went around, tried to talk to 8 or 9 different companies that to try to do what I wanted to do to see if somebody could help us, and nobody could. They all wanted like 100 people doing this or 300 people doing that. And what we need to do is really build teams of certain things. So we just kind of created our own, what's called a captive, built our own business, started in the Philippines and kicked it off. Got a couple of the guys, this is the CEO of Amex today, who's been running for the last decade, has killed it. At the time was 25 years old. He was like way down in the ranks on the ice, on the sales team, but he was a really sharp guy. And I said, hey, you want a challenge? He goes, well, I go, why don't you go to the Philippines for a year? Run this operation, kick this thing off. I'll come over and I'll work with you and we'll do it. He built that up. We got it going and we moved our customer service, our small business sales. Now we do this in 2006 and 2007, right before the global financial crisis. So one of those things, when you look back in the business, you say, once again, kind of good timing. So we redo our entire cost structure of our business right before the world collapses. And then simultaneously to this was, we also looked around and said, you know what? We're not making any money on some of this stuff. And we got rid of 80% of our SKUs. And we just streamlined. We took the hit in 06, did this thing. Anyways, this takes off. We get it going. We're building up. And then, you know, you and I are in YPO, EO, where people are watching what we're doing. And people say, hey, I want you to help me with this. Can we? And that time we called it a call center. They say, can we be in your call center? I said, no, I get out of here. You know, it's like, I got enough problems. I'm not, you know, I can take care of your problem. And so I had a couple of guys that kept pestering me and pestering me, The one guy finally said, I said, okay, I'll help you do it. Set him up. We hired a bunch of workers for him. I said, you got to go. We'll just sit you over here in the corner. And we got going. So we just started helping people. They started coming to us all word of mouth to kind of build out a business that to help them build what we would call today offshore teams to run their businesses or kind of global capability centers. About 8 years ago, 9 years ago, we look around and we got 5 times as many people as we're helping as we're doing ourselves. We spin the business out and we get it, start a new company, get a new space. We get going and we take it from there. And about 6 years ago, we brought in a CEO right as the pandemic was hitting to take over. And then that business just blew up. And CEO and the leadership team's done an awesome job. We've grown to kind of, we're approaching 2,000 full-time employees. We've got about 200 clients. Some of our clients have 200 or 300 people. Some of our clients have 2, 3, or 4. Some have 30, 40. But it's been an interesting business. And it's kind of been part of our, what we decided to do as a strategy we developed in 06 and 07 was we said, look, we're going to set our business up, I guess our group, if you will, what you'd probably call today is almost similar to a PE company, like a platform. And we'll have the, we'll use the shared services and we'll just keep adding things on as they go along. So this business was, we didn't go into this business, knowing anything about it. I have no expertise outside of what I did, starting my own campfire in the Philippines, but we just built it and we grew it. Now, what's also interesting about that is, we go out and talk to prospective clients and people come to us. That's one thing they really like about it, because today Amex still has, now Amex is a client of iSupport, because we said, well, why do we have this over here? Let's just be a client. You know, we've got over 100 team members, 61 different roles across 8 departments. You know, we're eating our own dog food. So if I'm talking to a founder, a CEO, something like that, I go, here's what we did. Here's how we did it. This is what you can do. And that resonates with a lot of people.
So you today have 3 CEOs running 3 different companies. So tell me about a time you watched one of them make a mistake or make a decision you disagreed with and you decided to stay quiet. What happened?
I mean, it's a really, I think, it's funny. It's a good question to ask. I think the biggest thing, it wasn't so much hard for me when you saw someone make a mistake. I think when each of the CEOs first came on, except for one, it was a little different. It was harder for the other people that had worked for me because they said, Fred wouldn't have done that. If Fred was here, we wouldn't be doing this. And I think that was a bigger issue to deal with. It wasn't so much like, hey, look, people are going to make mistakes. Nobody bats 1,000 in baseball. Nobody hits every free throw in the NBA. You're not there. I think for me, so that was a big thing, was managing that dealing with people that have been used to dealing with me. A couple of things we had done on that were, when each CEO came on, we got him a coach, and the coach worked with them from day one to help them develop, because none of them, except for one, none of them had been CEOs before. And we wanted to make sure they had success. We encouraged them to join peer groups. Number of them joined YPO, which was one of those moments where you're saying like, well, a couple of people said, you sure you want to do that? And I said, yeah, I do, because I wanted to be in YPO and I wanted to learn about all the great things you have. And I wanted to be surround smarter people and do that. Did people make mistakes? I would much rather have somebody beg for forgiveness than to ask for permission.
Yeah, well said.
I want people to go out there and do that. Look, they're not going to be at me. They're not going to be you. They're going to be their own person. They'll do that. But if they're aligned with, and that part of the CEO is coming in, is that CEO then has to take on what, Mark? The number one thing, vision. They have to set the vision plan and have to set it for their team, because they're driving it. Now, I'm aware of what those are, and I might have some input into that. But if I'm on the day-to-day stuff, how the hell? I'm not the best one to speak to that. I've never had a CEO do anything fatal in the sense of something that would be cause for termination around, let's say, a value or, something like that. That would be it. Are there things I said, hey, you want to walk me through that? You know what I mean? But overall, I'd say they've been pretty darn good. They've done really well. And look, and I think that is you as a founder, you have to step away and say, I can't play every minute of every quarter. And if I want to have a bigger, better thing, I gotta let them go and run with it. And you know what? They probably are going to be better than me. People will ask me and say, well, why don't you want to be involved in the business? And I said, well, it depends. I was involved in the business and I love business and I have a curiosity and I want to be involved and I love the businesses and I'm still in all of them. But what I do today is radically different. I'm not running operations. A funny story is, about 6 months ago, I went to my office in Seattle. I hadn't been there in about 18 months. I hadn't even gone to the office. I go down there. My key didn't even work. I had to walk around the back of the office, go through the loading dock. And the guy's, hey, Bob, it's like, I got to walk in. Times change. And, I think one of the things too is I've been in business like at Amex for 38 years. It's a completely different business today. I think the big thing is too, is if you're making that transition and you're letting the CEO go, at least the way I look at it is it's a young person's game today. I can't keep up. I do not have the mental bandwidth to be able to understand and effectively put everything together that, you know, some of the team leaders that I have that are making things happen. I mean, I just kind of sit there and like just nod my head a lot. Now, that doesn't mean I can't, you know, there's other things I can't do, but it's really, if we want to go to the next level, that next level is not going to be driven by me. I'm going to support them and encourage them and coach them, and we'll invest in it, but it's going to be leaders. It's going to be those CEOs on the ground that are going to make it happen.
You've done a really good job, Fred, in hiring and inspiring and letting go of that grip that one can have and letting them lead. And it's probably one of the main reasons it led to the success that you've had. It, truly a great job that others faced with these same facts, very difficult for a founder to let go to another CEO. If you were to summarize in a sentence, what advice would you give a founder that would like to put a CEO in place and is vacillating on making that decision?
Well, I think at the end of the day, and this probably goes, let's say you're a founder. I think as founders, we're all running our own race. And I never really like to give advice. We learned that, you know, we're both in YPO. A lot of times advice is contextual and it's wrong. So I just rather give shared experiences. I think you got to say, I'm going to run my own race. What do I want? If this is it, you know, what do I think? And you have to look that through your into yourself and say, what do I want professionally? What do I want personally? What do I want spiritually? What do I want for my family? And you got to balance all of those. I mean, if it's really important to you to be a billionaire, okay, then you prioritize that. But then, you know, there'll be other things that you're going to not be able to participate in and do. But if you are the founder and you're giving it up, I would just say, look, you run your own race, decide what that race is, and then also step back and say, if you want to stay in the company, what, how do you do it? I mean, I want to be in things where A, I can, you know, realistically bring value still. I don't want to be like, you know, hey, let's do this. You know, it's like, shut up. You know what I mean? So there's got to be some value I can bring. And at the same time too, what does it give me for energy? If I'm not getting energy out of it, I just don't want to be involved for positive energy. And so, I mean, those would be, I guess what I'd be looking at is, and you have to decide is what are you going to, if you want to get to second base, you got to take your foot off first. So if you're giving up something, what are you going to get in return? And then realize that, look, you just, you're going through a transition and you'll do that. Now, our business was, you know, I was in such a boring business, in the glove business, that nobody ever paid any attention to. It wasn't like anybody was knocking on my door, particularly in Seattle, which is a big tech area, to say, hey, I really didn't want to invest in a glove business. So fortunately, we were able to retain 100% of the ownership to this day. That gives us a lot of latitude to make decisions like, hey, I want to go live in China. Hey, I want to do this. You know, we want to do this with the business that, you know, helps us. I mean, you asked a question to me once before, which is kind of in the CEO role about what are the things when all there's this chaos, what can you do to control things? And how do you control it? Or, you know, when things are out of control, you know, what we talk about, and this goes back to is you got to sit back and say, what do I control? You got to focus on what you can control. There's going to be no the shortage of shit you can't control, but what you can control? And then what, then how do we align people around that? I'll give you an example. This last year, you know, President Trump, who, by the way, didn't call me up to ask me any questions about the tariffs, you know, puts in the tariffs. And right away on April 3rd, all of a sudden, April 2nd, whatever it was, Liberation Day, we had a $7 million hole in our P&L. That means that we were going to lose $7 million because, by the way, the Chinese don't pay the tariffs. Companies that import products pay tariffs. And we knew that. So look, there's a lot of bad things suddenly we can't control. Okay. But what we can control is our balance sheet. We control a balance sheet. So what does that mean? We can go and lever our balance sheet up because we have significant resources and we can buy 2 or 3 months out more. That gives us more breathing room to work with our clients and help them navigate that. That allows us to keep, you know, our cogs in control to do that. That allows us to go in and lever in with our manufacturers to set the tone that we're going to expect you to share in the, you know, the pain on this. And hence we want better prices. So up and down the organization, the team comes back and says, what can we do to control this? We got to put AI in. We're putting AI in across the business for the last 2.5 years. Okay. Why? We got to lean everything out. What can we do? We can control that. Last year, we grew the top line by 15%. We cut our global footprint by 15%.
What is, I get changed directions on you. Would you say the biggest mistake you ever made was, and what did it teach you?
Well, if I thought about it long enough, I'd probably just call my friends and they'd remind me of some stupid mistake I made. But I would say the mistake that I made was more along not acting quicker and missing opportunities than it was doing something wrong where I took it into the ditch. And by that, I mean, if I look back and I say, okay, what are some of the areas that I did not master well? I did not master people well early on. You know, they always tell you, oh, you should hire the smartest, the best people. That's going to happen. I don't know. I frankly, truth be told, I was a little scared by that. You know, why would I want to hire a couple of really smart people that might just take the business from me? You know, but as you grow and you realize that it's a team and you're developing it, and you're only going to get so far by yourself. I mean, you look back and think of all the people, Mark, that we've been involved with, your EO, through YPO, that, you know, there's a couple reasons their businesses never grew. One, it was the capacity of their business. I mean, you could be the best guy selling pagers, but there's no pagers aren't sold anymore. But there was also capacity on, so maybe our business was regional, or it was inhibited by geography. But then there was also, Mark, a lot of people we knew that just, they were just inhibited. They were, their growth was going to be retarded by their capacity to change and to adapt. And I look at that and I say, look, I could have done a better job at working with A players, developing them, coaching them, leading them, and then delegating them. I think if I had done that early on, more often, I think we would be ahead of where we are today. And so I think that would be probably one mistake that I made.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that. At EO, forever, the median revenue was between $3 and $3.5 million. And it was hard to break out. You could control everything up to about that point. And if you ask anyone in EO, hey, I want to go from three, what success 3 years from now? They usually tell you, hey, 10 million, growing from 3 or 3.5 to 10, that is success. But they got to get out of their comfort zone in order to achieve that. And that's probably what you just described a moment ago.
And I think that actually triggers me. I think you brought up a pretty good point, is that you always emphasize on, you got to think big. You got to get out there and do that. And then thinking big is not going from 3 to 8 million, you know. And I look back and but that goes back to the individual. Are you want to think big? And that's, you want to think big in your business. You want to think big in your life, personally, in your relationships, whatever that might be, you're not thinking big. And I think that I look back and when I went to those, I had a mentor of mine that once told me something. We always try and do this. I always try and use this as kind of my way I look it through a lens at is you got to be opportunity focused, not problem focused. Because if you focus on a problem, all you really do is fix the pothole. You kind of get back to even. But if you focus on an opportunity and you capitalize on that and you can execute, you make a quantum leap forward. And you keep doing that over and over again. That's a mindset of what you want to do. And then all of a sudden, 8 becomes 80, becomes 250, becomes a billion, or whatever that might be. And I think that's a mindset that some people can't do that. And I think, Mark, it also speaks to what you've talked about before is, you know, few people get there alone. I mean, you and I were fortunate to have been, I didn't have any formal experience in business. I was self-taught and I was very fortunate to get into EO, into YPO, and then have those peer networks of people that just told you to your face, hey, you got to do this. Or more importantly, people that just inspired you and said, God, look what he's doing or look what she's doing and making you happen. And then coupling it with a coach who's going to say, hey, are you asking, you know, what is always said? We all have the answers. Do we have the right questions? And the coach is where I think that if, you know, if somebody was listening to this, that I would talk to somebody today is, I mean, I just invest in this company and great company. And I talked to the CEO about getting a coach. And I was like, yeah, you know, usually the usual stuff. You know, I'm busy, this and that, you know, I'm different. Yeah, you know, whatever. Yeah, you've got the one different business in the world, I know. And I finally, I circled back with him after this, the senior plan thing. I said, okay, I'm just going to give us some, I'm going to give us some kind of semi-gentle but firm advice. I said, tell me who the greatest soccer player, you know, football player is in the world. He's a European guy. And does he have a coach? Well, you know, it was debated. I wasn't sure if it was Messi or Ronaldo or Mbappe. You know, they all have coaches, right? Every great athlete, every great, anybody who's done anything has a great coach. Explain to me why you're different, you know? And so we talked about that. And I think that'll just, if you have, that'll make you better.
What would say Sheldon's been your coach and the coach of your team for a long time, almost 9 years, I think. What's been the, if you were to pick one, and I know that's a tough question, what's the biggest impact that Sheldon has had on you or your leadership team?
You know, I think with, if I had to say with Sheldon, for me is, I would say accountability. You know, we can, you, if you, a good coach, I think will open, it will ask you questions, will get you thinking. There's just not, it's not a, you know, if you want it to be a 60 minute therapy session, it can be, but that's an expensive therapy session. So it's really like, what do you want to, and what are you going to do to get out of that? And so I'm always like, well, what do you think about this? Or talk through it. I think too, is a, what a coach does is it allows you to talk through things, think about it from a different perspective. I've always been a big believer in what's one good idea worth. You know, you go along, nothing, and all of a sudden somebody says something, you go, what'd you just say? You know what I mean? And then, but I think so it's accountability. But when you meet with like Sheldon, it's like, how do you like listen, put yourself in the mindset to, for growth, to learn? Because if you don't want to be there, it's a waste of time and money for you and then for the coach. But then I think that gives you, it gives you a lot, it sets you up to say, okay, now we're action-based. Now we're going to be accountable to the coach. You know, we do Sheldon, you know, quarterly sessions, yearly planning sessions. You know, he personally coaches Keo. He's coached some other folks. I've recommended CEO coaching to people, you know, in Asia, to the United States. We've, I, a couple of people just recently came on board with you guys. I guess that would be my, that would be the, probably the one thing. And then there's that, that consistency of working with somebody, you know, kind of not so much day in and day out, but, you know, there to say, okay, we did this. Now I got to, you know, report back and here's what I need to do and here's what I want to get out of it. And they help you, I think they just help you be better.
Full transparency, I use Sheldon as well as my coach. And I love it when he just hits me right between the eyes and says what I need to hear. And but he does that by asking the right questions first. And he facilitates our quarterly too. So I can participate rather than try to be the guy facilitating. So I got two questions left for you. This one's amazing. So you turn 60 or and you get this crazy idea. You've climbed most of the big mountains in the world and you decide to take up this new sport and you want to compete in the world championship. Tell us about that. I think it's just so epic.
Well, so during the pandemic, when we came back, you know, we go over to Idaho a lot and, you know, you remember you couldn't really do anything. So I said, well, I'm going to try cross country skiing. I've always been a downhiller, you know, but as I got older, every time I fell, it didn't feel so good. And so I said, I'm going to try, you know, and I go, this has looked pretty good. So a guy was talking to me. So I started, I went out cross country skied and then I skied a little more and, you know, being a type A personality, I go, well, I should do a race, you know? And so I went and did this race during the pandemic. There was nobody in the race because you couldn't have races, but it was really stupid. You go and you hit a little QR code and you do this thing. And, you know, I said, you know what? I think I want to do this. And, you know, I have this magnet that I have in my, at my house in my, you know, magnet you stick on the wall and it had a saying on it. And I've had this magnet for several years and I've always believed in it. It says, if your dreams don't scare you, they're not big enough. You know, and so we all have dreams like, you know, I want to go to Chick-fil-A today, you know, or I want to, or whatever that might be. But a lot of people we talk, you know, I always think about it, particularly as you talk to people who are older and people, always tell you about like what they've done. They always tell you about what they didn't do or what they wish they'd done. So I go, you know what? I'm going to do this cross-country skiing thing. I think I'm going to enter some races. Well, I'm fortunate I've got dual nationality. So I called up. I sent a letter to the or an email to the head of the National Olympic Committee. And I said, hey, I want to try out for your national team, for the cross-country team. Guy goes, okay, no problem. Gets me on the line. Say, he goes, we got to get you set up with what's called an FIS number, Federation of International Skiing. I go, okay. So they get up. I get this number. It's through this organization. I get an FIS number. And I go, great. And so I go back to him. I got my number. He goes, I go, so what about the team? He goes, you're pretty much the team. And I go, okay. So he goes, well, just go to this website. There's a bunch of races on there. You just, you know, pick the ones you want to enter in if you want to. And if you need any help, give me a call back. So I said, okay. So I just went to the website and I looked around. I said, okay, well, I'll enter some races. Now, this is a little problematic because I'm really not that good of a skier. I never really attempted this cross-country skiing until like right before that. And this is like thing, like you go out a little and, you know, cross-country skiing is, it's really hard. You know, you look at these guys on TV. I remember the first day I went out and I saw these people moving on TV and I went out and I go like, I get on my skis. I go about 50 feet and fall over. And then I go, hey, these things really only work when you're going downhill, you know? But then I went downhill. I had to come back up the hill. I was out there in the tracks, I think, you know, forever. Anyways, I start practicing. I start doing this. I sign up and go to my first race. I get dead last. In fact, by the time I finished in this race, everybody had left the stadium. I'm the last guy. There's one guy sitting there. I remember coming in. I was in Houghton, Michigan. It's about 15 Celsius. It's 15 degrees Fahrenheit, but cold. And this guy's standing there. I go, well, maybe this guy's going to need the guy to drug test me or something. I don't know. I pull in and he looks at me and go, I need your jersey. Oh, okay. That's it. He's waiting to get my jersey so I could do it. Anyway, so the next year I go and I sign up for a couple more races. Then I decide to go do this race in Norway. And I have some friends up there and they go, well, you got to talk to this guy. So by now I'm kind of practicing a little. I've taken a couple lessons, but you know, every race, Mark, I go to, I'm getting dead last. So I go to Northern Norway. I meet this guy. They say, you got to talk to this guy named Thomas. And I go, okay. So I go to meet him. Well, ends up, Thomas is a major in the Norwegian Army. And he does all of the training programs in the Norwegian Army. And I have a friend who's in the Army up there. And so we go in there. Thomas, they test me. We do the VO2 max. We do the blood, everything like that. And I say, okay, this and that. And he goes, and I go, well, here's my situation. I'd like to travel. I'd like to go to the Olympics. Everything like that. Well, it ends up Thomas's cousin is the number two guy in the Norwegian ski team on the national team. He goes, well, here's your problem. He goes, if you want to go to the Olympics, you have to first go to the World Championships. And he goes, I go, yeah, but I got a problem. You know, every race I'm in, Thomas, I get dead last almost. He goes, no problem. You get points. And I said, what do you mean? You're awarded points. Now, this is the importance of having a good coach, right? I don't even know how you're graded. I'm just out there and I'm getting my butt kicked. Now you understand, I'm 60 years old. I'm up against like the Romanian national team. You know, I mean, the guys that are young. Anyway, so Thomas goes, here's what you need to do. We need to pick these races out. So he kind of like, you know, helps me make a plan. We ski a little together. We pick up some races. We go, and long and short of it is, and last fall he calls up and he goes, or this is fall of 2024. And he goes, okay, you're qualified for the qualifying race for the World Cup in Trondheim, Norway. So I was the first person in the history of Malta to qualify for the World Cup race. So we went down for that race. It was a qualifying race. And then there was another race. He calls me about a month before and he goes, hey, you're actually in the World Championships in the sprint race. And I said, no, I'm not. I mean, in cross-country skiing, there's three races. There's sprints. There's like mid-distance, like 5, 10 kilometers, and there's long distance. No, my points aren't good enough because it doesn't matter. If you qualify this one, you're automatically getting the race. So anyways, we go to the World Championships. We ski in the World Championships. It was a great event, but I get there, and I'm kind of not really processing this correctly. I didn't know that this was that big of a deal. So the day of the race, I get up there, and they go, you know, I'm reading the newspapers in Trondheim, and they're going, they sold 250,000 tickets. Now, usually I'm out in the, you know, skiing out in the woods and nobody cares who you are or whatever. So I go to them and I go, hey, you know, they're putting a stadium together. There's 25,000 people watching. And I told them about 3 days before, I go, this is a really bad idea. I'm going to be skiing in front of 25,000 people. And I don't think I should do this race. He goes, no, you don't realize it is the dream of every Norwegian to ski in this race. You must do it. And I go, okay, if you put it that way, let's do it. So we did it. But anyways, I went out. It was a great experience. Skied in that race. It ended up being really kind of funny in a way because I'm like the oldest guy by a long shot. I mean, the guys that won were in their early 20s. I'm 61 years old. And one of those funny stories, I have my jacket on and it says, you know, Malta on the back. And this guy walks up to me and he goes, is it true that there's a 61-year-old skier on the Maltese ski team? And I go, I looked at him, yeah, there is, you know, and I go, I start walking down. And he goes, well, I'm from the Austrian TV. I want to interview him, blah, 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 blah. And I go, okay, well, look, tell you what, when I'm done with the race, I'll come talk to you. And he goes, oh, you are him. So anyways, it was funny because then all the other guys that were old, this one guy comes up to me, he goes, and this guy from the, he comes out and he, parking lot, he goes, dude, I cannot believe you are 61 years old. I thought I was the oldest guy here at 42. So anyways, it was a great story. Long and short of it was a great adventure. And one thing I've always liked to do is, you know, you were thinking about it, you know, it's probably similar to you. I never look, you know, a lot of people think they have a career. I looked at my business as more of a journey, and it was going to be an adventure along the way. I remember even when LinkedIn came out 10 years ago, I go, why do I go on that? I never had a job. You know what I mean? I'm not looking for a job. Anyways, I think this was just part of that journey. And you're asking, like, why wouldn't you do something? It's like, heck, you know, like, if you're going to go do something, you know, go do something big or at least try for it. So I didn't make the Olympics. Somebody said, what happened? I go, it was real simple. I wasn't fast enough. But, you know, it doesn't mean I can't try again in 2 years to go back to the world championships.
Awesome story and super inspiring. You're a crazy man. That's what I love about you. All right, last question for the entrepreneur or CEO listening to this who wants to build a big life and have a meaningful business at the same time, what advice would you give them?
We talked a little about it before. I think I would just sit back and look with some personal self-reflection and say, you know, what race do you want to run? You know, what are the most important things for you? Whether it's, you know, if it's professional, I think when we're younger, for me, I look back and that was a real big focus of mine. But is it, you know, how do you want to incorporate family into that? How do you want to incorporate your friends into that? How do you want to incorporate your faith into that, you know, or your community or whatever it might be? It's a balance of those things where you're going to look back when you get to, I mean, you're a big, and I follow your narrative all the time, Mark. And I think you lead it better than anybody I know, you know. Some people will say, oh, you're never going to have balance in your life and be, you know, Elon Musk. Okay, maybe you're not. I don't know. But if you want to be Elon Musk, only Elon Musk could be Elon Musk. You have to be yourself, whatever that might be. So I would just say that would be that balance of doing it and then deciding that, you know, what that is. I mean, I think what I like about business is being particularly an entrepreneur is it gives you, as opposed to an employee, it gives you control over kind of your destiny, if you will, to determine what you want to do and do that. And I think it gives you the vehicle to do that. I look back and really what I wanted to do when I first started was I wanted to build an international business so I could, you know, have a lifelong adventure seeing the world.
Fred, you and I have been friends for 30 years. And I just want to say congratulations on all that you've done personally with your family and with your business and living the life you want to live and the ability to run your own race. And thank you for being willing to share your story on the Make Big Happen podcast. You're clearly a guy who makes big happen. Thank you, Fred.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
There are three kinds of people: those who make big happen, those who let things happen, and those who ask what happened. Don't just listen to these stories. Decide who you're going to be. Show notes and resources are available at CEOcoachinginternational.com. Subscribe so you don't miss what's next. At some point, every leader faces a choice. Play it safe or go big. If you're ready to make big happen, visit CEOcoachinginternational.com and learn how our been there, done that CEO coaches can help you make big happen.